Did you know using your browser in incognito mode doesn't actually protect your privacy? Take back your privacy with IPVanish VPN. Just one tap and all your data, passwords, communications, browsing history, and more will be instantly protected. IPVanish makes you virtually invisible online. Use IPVanish on all your devices, anytime you go online at home, and especially on public Wi-Fi. Get IPVanish now for 70% off a yearly plan with this exclusive offer at ipvanish.com/audio.
Welcome to the Michael Steele Podcast. Coming up, folks, we have a great conversation with 2024 Democratic candidate for the presidency of the United States, Marianne Williamson. Some may say, "What, Marianne Williamson? What are you talking about?" She is a legit candidate. She's running, and she's in conversation with me, and I'm looking forward to her. She's not just an author, lecturer, and activist. But she has something to say that is intriguing and profoundly important, particularly when it came to our conversation regarding Israel and Palestine. So settle in, grab a cup of coffee or maybe a shot or two. You may need it because we have a row from time to time. And it's a lot of fun with Marianne Williamson, candidate for president of the United States, coming up on the Michael Steele Podcast. Hey, everybody, welcome into the Michael Steele Podcast. This is a special treat for us, to have a presidential candidate, someone who brings not just ideas but experience to the table to come in and talk. I'm really excited about that. And to be able to welcome Marianne is, to me, a real treat. So welcome.
Thank you. It's a treat for me as well. So thank you for having me on, Michael.
Oh, absolutely. So, we were talking a little bit before we got started. There's a lot going on, and I want to get to all of the headlines, because I think your insights and take on some of this is going to be very valuable. But before we do, just give me your sense right now, as you having been out on the streets of America, talking with citizens, what's your sense of how the American people are framing current events? Not, I don't want to get specifically at this point into, what's happening in Israel or the crazy that's the GOP, but just more broadly, what's the vibe you're getting back from people? Are they hungry for some change? Are they kind of sort of settled in the status quo? Are they hopeless? Mm-hmm. What's your sense of what you're picking up out there from the American people right now?
It's not so much like 2020 as it's like 2016. Mm. What you and I call current events is not the main current event for the majority of American people. The main current event for the majority of American people is that person is living paycheck to paycheck. The main current event for the American people is that 1 in 4 of them are living with medical debt. The main current event is how many millions of them have college loan debt. The main current event is that 1/3 of the working people of the United States are living on less than $15 an hour and cannot afford a place to live. The housing crisis, the homelessness, that's the current event for the average American. So what you and I call current events, and I agree with you, they're important, but the majority of Americans feel left out of that conversation, powerless before that conversation, and so disempowered in their own lives, which in many cases are actually falling apart, that the political elite and the political establishment is really missing something not to recognize what's going on out there.
And actually, to that point, Marianne, that was the gateway to Trumpism in 2016. That
you better believe it was, Michael.
We're missing.
That's my point.
What folks were trying to tell them.
That's my point. Now, it's got a double-edged situation here. Because I remind you, in 2016, there were two candidates telling people that their rage was justified, the system was rigged, and it was rigged against them. Bernie and Trump, right? The difference was that Bernie meant it and would have done something about it. I remind you that the Democratic Party suppressed that. What's happening now is there's a slight complication. Those who are angry about it, many of them are going to vote for Trump. There's no point in even discussing Trump anymore. Those who love him are going to vote for him, even if he's in prison. Our bigger risk is people whose rage is turned inward. They're depressed. The issue there is not that they're going to vote for Trump. The issue there is that they're going to stay home. That's the biggest risk to those who do not want Trump in the White House again, is how many people, if we do not respond fundamentally and adequately to their despair, particularly their economic anxiety, will simply stay home in 2024. And that will put Trump back in the White House.
I know you're running against the incumbent president, Joe Biden, but what is it about the idea of these voters staying home that would make them do that? Are they missing? Is it okay? They're not hearing me, so therefore I don't want to participate. Is it Donald Trump and all the Trumpism stuff? At this point, given the 91 indictments and the collapse of his empire in many respects, he's no longer a threat. What animates this sense of sort of checking out of the system? Because for me, I'm like, this is the time to check in. You know, it's like, no, let's
better believe it.
Level
you better
up
believe
here.
It. The issue is not what they are missing. The issue is what Washington is missing. Mm-hmm. The issue is what Wall Street is missing. The issue is what the elite are missing. The people are not missing anything. The people I'm talking about do not like Trump. But you know, if daddy beat you up and mommy stood outside the door and didn't do anything about it except offer you milk and cookies later, you grow up and in therapy, you're more angry at mommy for letting it happen. What they're not missing anything. It's what they are seeing. They are seeing, for instance, and this is particularly applicable to Gen Z, they're seeing a president who calls himself the climate president, who has admittedly done some healthy investments in green energy in the Inflation Reduction Act, then actually, on the other hand, giving more oil drilling permits than even Trump did. That same president okaying the Willow Project, the $8 billion ConocoPhillips oil extraction program on the North Slopes of Alaska, overseeing an $858 billion defense budget, which is the single largest global emitter, institutional emitter of greenhouse gases, thereby nullifying all benefits of the healthy green energy investments in the Inflation Reduction Act. They see that. They see the fact that while he promised to raise the minimum wage to $15 and did for federal workers, when it came to putting it in the COVID relief bill, he was stopped by the parliamentarian. No Republican president allows themselves to be stopped by the parliamentarian. Mm-hmm. George Bush fired the parliamentarian. They see the fact that their medical debt is $88 billion in total. They see the fact that nothing is really helping them. And when they are told to be happy about Bidenomics, 20% of us can be happy about Bidenomics. But those of us for whom the economy is working, and we celebrate that, of course, but those 20% of us are living on an island of denial. And that island is surrounded by a vast swath, a sea of economic despair. That is what is happening.
But a lower inflation rate, a lower gas prices from where they were a year ago, a higher job rate or lower unemployment number, that just doesn't redound to the benefit of 20% of Americans. The economy isn't built that way. So the very people you're talking about are working. They are seeing lower costs for goods and services. So right. What else is angering people? Because objectively, the math doesn't work. The math doesn't tell you that. I mean, when you're looking at 3.6 unemployment as opposed to 7.8, if you're looking at, you know, 3.5% or 6.5% of inflation versus 9. What else is driving this? Because objectively, the numbers don't make sense for people to be as pissed off as they claim to be about the things they claim to be pissed off about.
I'm not even saying people are all pissed off. Many of them have just fallen into depression, anxiety. It's what we call the mental health crisis.
But around
addiction.
What?
Addiction. Okay, hold on a second. You just mentioned the unemployment rate. But what you didn't mention was how many of those jobs are jobs that people could live on with just one job. Okay. You didn't mention what the minimum wage was, on whether or not it was a living wage. In most major American cities, in all major American cities, living wage is over $20 an hour. Now, Michael, you and I both remember the 1970s. I think you remember. So in the 1970s, the average worker had decent benefits. They could afford a car. They could afford a home. They could afford a yearly vacation. They could afford for one parent to stay home with the kids if they wanted. And they could afford to send their kids to college. So right now, it's true about inflation. There are some cyclical aspects here. There are, that inflation goes up and down. I mean, that stuff does happen. The issue is that for the majority of Americans, they can't absorb it. Because without universal health care, without tuition-free college, with all these college loan debts, it's not just inflation. It's the fact that their lives can't absorb the horrors of it. You and I can absorb inflation. And when you tell people, well, your gasoline prices are going to be lower, that's good. So what you're saying to people is, we will help you survive. There are too many people living on survival. There's a difference between living on survival and being in the game so that you could actually thrive. And that's what the elite simply will not look at. Oh, you're helping people. So it's like the Republicans are saying, we're going to give you crumbs. It's like the corporatist Democrats are saying, no, we're going to give you cookies. What I'm saying is, you can't live on cookies either. It's a real blind spot in Washington for us to say, well, what are these people, I mean, upset about? Their unemployment numbers are down and the gas prices are down. Like, blind spot, blind spot. I'm sorry. And so it's not what they're not getting, it's what we're not getting. And we're not talking about how people should feel. That's where the Democrats get in trouble. This is how people should feel. No, how about how this is how people do feel? And you might want to take that into account if you're trying to beat Donald Trump in 2024.
Let's pull back, because the one thing in the times that you and I have spoken in the past, I love engaging with you around the policy and the ideas, and because a lot of it for me, as someone who sees the government as a limited purpose entity, I'm not an anti-government Republican. I recognize, having served in state government, especially, the proper role and function of government, making it work and do some of the things that you've just talked about. So the question for someone like me, and speaking with someone like you, is like, okay, so where do we start to do this? How do we begin to do this? But before we get into that part, how do you paddle upstream in a Democratic primary where the political system, as we've seen in both Democrat and Republican primaries, wants to lock out the challenge to the conversation, that, you know, there will be no debates for the Democratic challengers. In fact, one of your rivals, Robert F. Kennedy Jr., decided to step out of the Democratic primary altogether and going to run as an independent. Okay, well, we don't know what that will look like. You so far decided to stick it through the Democratic process. What are the hopes that you're actually going to get on that stage? And how do you battle back against the notion that people will look at your candidacy as a gadfly, that, oh my God, Marianne's running again? What does this mean? You know, you've heard it. I'm not saying anything, and I'm not being disrespectful, I hope.
No, you're not. I
have immense respect for anyone who wants to take it up, but there is a question of, okay, just how serious is this, or how serious can it be?
Okay.
You seem to tackle that in a way that others have not in the past. Talk to me a little bit about how you approach that attitude inside the Democratic Party.
I do want to point out that your first question was very different, so I hope we'll get back to that as well, because you also brought up a very fundamental issue about the role of government that I also...
Oh, no, really, I definitely want to get to it. Absolutely.
Yeah, okay, we'll get back to that. So in terms of the Democratic Party, Robert Kennedy is correct in his analysis. Robert Kennedy also has a huge war chest, and he has the name Kennedy. So he has, he has abilities, he has options that I don't necessarily have. However, I will say this. A lot of people see what the Democratic Party is doing and they don't like it. The majority of Americans want to see someone else. The majority of Democrats have made it clear that they want to see their other options. Now, I'm sure you realize Cenk Uygur has gotten into the race, and Dean Phillips might get into the race. And this scuttlebutt about the president is getting higher and higher. things could happen in the next 2 or 3 weeks that would cause someone else to come in if his poll numbers keep dropping. Now, I think the situation in Israel probably impacts that. All I know is what happens when people actually hear me, Michael. A narrative has been created about me. You know, last time she's kooky, she's wacky, she's a crystal lady, almost with this bemused smile from the pseudo elite, right. The pseudo sophisticates, right. The pseudo intellectuals. They were satisfied to just mock me and make fun of me. This time, they call me unserious because they know how serious I am. They know that the majority of Republicans as well as Democrats want universal health care, which they realize they have in every other advanced democracy. The elite realizes that the majority of Republicans as well as Democrats want tuition-free college and tech school, which they have in every other advanced democracy. The elite realizes that what I'm saying, better not let her on CNN, better not let her on MSNBC, because she's silly? No. But because I might start a political wildfire. And that is what my campaign starts among people who hear me. Now, what you said is true. What Bobby said is true. They do everything possible to block me. I know you know this, Michael. You spent as much time in the belly of this beast mm-hmm. as I have. It's a political media industrial complex. They don't just chop wood and carry water for huge corporate interests. They are a huge corporate interest.
Right.
People don't like it. People are registering it. And somebody's going to break through. Whether I'm that person or not is not as relevant as the fact that this dynamic exists, whether they are willing to recognize it or not. If my heart said, give it up today, Marianne, because there's no point, I guess I would. But I don't feel that that's what I'm supposed to do. And when people actually hear me, Michael, I, with all due respect, there's a lot more excitement at a Marianne Williamson campaign event than at a Biden-Harris campaign event.
So on that point, because I think it's important to, while we can talk about some of the policy things, you know, your economic bill of rights and things like that that you've put out, certainly a very important piece that you've put out on what's happening in Israel, and we want to talk about that. I think it's also important, though, to sort of, because politics is about framing. It is ultimately about the infrastructure as much as it is about the clothing mm-hmm. and the skin that overlays the infrastructure. Because mm-hmm. that's the part that allows you to move forward. You know, that mm-hmm. infrastructure allows you to move forward.
Yeah. So yeah, you need a vase for your flowers.
You need a vase for your flowers. That's very well put. So
it's very true.
What is your vase for the flowers that you have around, you know, the things that you've talked about, and how has the DNC, for example, dealt with that vase? And what role do you think they should be playing, given that, you know, part of it is incumbent protection? All right, we get that they're going to try to protect the incumbent president of their party. But also looking back when they have not done that, 1980 comes to mind with Jimmy Carter and Ted Kennedy. There's some real political consequences that flow from that also. So how does you see?
I know that the narrative is how important Teddy Kennedy was in 1980.
Right.
But reminder, Ronald Reagan defeated Jimmy Carter. Teddy Kennedy did not defeat Jimmy Carter. They're just made up that was such a huge factor.
But he weakened him.
Teddy Kennedy had not run in 1980. I grew up in a generation where Eugene McCarthy ran against Johnson. Bobby Kennedy ran against Johnson. This is a made up narrative. Ooh, you don't
yeah,
run against
Johnson. Yeah, but Johnson dropped out
president.
Of the campaign. He dropped out well, of the run for the presidency yeah,
exactly.
because of that.
That's my point. That's kind of my point as well. That's kind of what you're trying to make happen. You're showing the American people there's a much better option here. Now, then we had a problem with Humphrey and Nixon, no doubt about it. But that's not to say that we can logically conclude that Johnson would have won either.
Right.
So this what when you say what is the role of the political party? The role of the political party has never been to protect the incumbent. The role of the political party should be to facilitate democracy. The role of the political party is to stay in the background. I don't need to tell you this. You stay in the background. The people, not the political party, the people
Right.
The voters should decide who the candidate is. That's when the political party is supposed to come in and help the nominee. This is undemocratic. Candidate suppression is a form of voter suppression. It's like the Soviet Union when I was growing up. Yeah, you can vote, but they're going to tell you who you can vote for. So that's the role of the political party. This idea that they're so overt about protecting the president because he's the incumbent. This is a made up scheme. There's nothing in the Constitution. There's nothing in the real traditions of American politics to justify that.
No, they're not. You're right about that. But as these things have evolved.
I sure am.
You're absolutely right about that. And as these things have evolved, these systems mm-hmm. have evolved, meaning the political systems, that idea.
No. As the marketing has evolved, that's the problem. The political system, it's the tail is wagging the dog. The marketing should be to support the righteous use of the democratic process. Instead, the democratic process is being diminished to serve the marketing. This is dangerous.
I'll see that, but you still have to get on the stage. You still have to have the platform, right? So
absolutely.
Brittany Shepherd, in Politico wrote an interesting piece back in June in which she talked about. The headline was, "No incumbent president has participated in a primary debate since Ford. Democrats want to keep it that way." And President Biden and his team are looking at this landscape and are saying, there's no need for me to get out and do a debate with Marianne Williamson. Likewise, Donald Trump is looking at the cavalcade of Republicans who presumably want to take him out and saying, are you kidding me? There's no need for me to show up. As someone who's been a candidate and someone who's actually, organized these things for candidates, the more you participate and have the chance to make your case, particularly as an incumbent, the better. I've always said, what would I hide from? What am I running away from? If I'm right about what I'm doing, I'm going to get out, I'm going to make that case, and I'm going to show why a Marianne Williamson on the Democratic side or a Nikki Haley on the Republican side are just wrong, right? How do you convince people of that idea when you don't have that platform to do it because they won't give it to you?
Well, I have the right campaign. I just need to scale up.
Right.
And that's called money. That's called money. You know this as well as I do. So right now I need 1,000 people to send me $1,000 as soon as possible. I mean, it's really in ways that are very unfortunate for our democracy. That's all about money. I have to compensate. I have to be able to override the media blackout on me. I'll tell you something, Michael. I, in the polls, am higher than Nikki Haley. I'm higher than Vivek Ramaswamy. So they are given regular appearances on CNN, on MSNBC. They're on the Sunday morning shows. And I'm not for a reason. And it's not because they think I'm silly. It's because they know I'm talking about something very serious that establishment does not want out there because it would be very, very popular, given that it just so happens that my agenda aligns with the will of the American people. The will of the American people has become secondary to the will of the donor class. And more legislators in both parties do more to support the short-term profit maximization goals of their donors than the expressed will of their own constituents, the safety, the health, and the well-being of their constituents. That's called corruption, Michael. And that's why the slogan of my campaign is disrupt the corrupt. It's very corrupt. And the status quo will not disrupt itself. We need a revolution at the ballot box. And that's what my campaign offers.
What role, I mean, you talk about, getting on that platform and disrupting the corrupt and looking for the tools to do that. What role has TikTok played in your campaign in that regard?
Well, in the latest New York Times poll, in the tab that was Gen Z, 19 to 29, and now the old idea that young people don't vote. No, yes, they do. They're voting for their lives.
Yeah, that's
that
changing.
In 2022.
Yeah.
That's old.
Yeah.
Okay. The president was at 34%. I was at 27%, only 7 points behind him. And then Robert Kennedy was at 13 points. I am able to reach young people because they're on TikTok and it doesn't cost me any money to get on TikTok. I have to reach more than the young people, however, and that's where my being blocked by CNN and blocked by MSNBC is so wrong. And blocked in more places than that. I mean, the word has gone out. Some of the young Democratic clubs, it's just kind of astounding. I am a declared presidential candidate. And I'll tell you something else, Michael. I'm actually a kind of moderate person in terms of my sort of personal being.
Right.
Everything I'm talking about is considered a moderate position in every other advanced democracy. I'm just talking about, you know, like people creating wealth in America. That's a good thing. But no conscious person wants to feel they're creating wealth at the expense of other people getting a chance to. Too many people are locked out of ever having the opportunity. And many of the people, millions of the people who are locked out are children. We have millions of children in this country who are, by the time they're 10, they haven't even learned to read. And if you haven't learned to read by the age of 10, your chances of high school graduation are drastically decreased,
yeah,
and your chances of incarceration are drastically increased. We can't just look away from that and think that this is not going to create a volcano at some point. It already is creating a volcano. And we think that we can just limit its effects through prisons or through bombs or whatever. This is we are not being sophisticated. We are not being mature. We are not using critical thought.
So on that point, that's an interesting point, because when you go back to 2020, right, and your effort then, and you're looking at your effort now, does it feel different? Does 2020 or 24 feel different from 20? And if
yes.
So, how has your campaign changed from the last time that you were trying to put in front of the American people a number of the ideas that we're going to talk about in a moment?
In 2020, the average Democratic voter had an understandable panic and focus. All I want to do is get rid of Donald Trump. All I want to do is get rid of Donald Trump. Who can beat Donald Trump?
Right.
And they would say about certain things, I said, well, she's right, you know, but I just want to beat Donald Trump. That's understandable. But in retrospect, we can all see it was very naive as well, because a certain cat had already been let out of the bag, and just defeating Donald Trump did not put it back in. So now, and I think COVID is part of this, I think a lot of things are part of this now, the audience has matured. There's a deeper listening. There's a recognition. Once again, I see this in so many ways, Michael, the people are not the problem. The government and the perspective that dominates the elite political establishment, that's back in the 1990s somewhere. The people get it. The people realize something is wrong at a deeper level.
Mm-hmm.
People realize that transactional politics, just tweak it here, tweak it there, this particular candidate or that, this particular issue or that, playing whack-a-mole all the time. People realize that the problem goes deeper. So when I talk about that and having a deeper conversation among those who are in the audience, there's a lot more nodding of the heads and a lot more willingness. You know, Michael, if you take any two Americans and say, you're going to go out to dinner tonight, the probability is by the end of dinner, they're having a very real conversation. We get real. We get authentic. And you talk to an American sitting next to an American on the airplane, we go straight for it and we get real.
Mm-hmm.
But in our political conversations, we've all been trained to think like sixth graders. We've been trained to keep it shallow.
I'm not going to argue with that one.
We have been trained to just parrot narratives that the political party
true.
Handed down.
It's very
and
true.
Americans realize there's danger there. We have given up our serious thinking to a political class that is not what the founders intended. So what I see out there, people want to get out of their silos. Enough with who's left, who's right. Enough with who's black, who's white. Enough. We
but
need
how
to
does
remember.
That, Marianne, how does that break through? I mean, look, anyone sitting
Stay
here
up.
Actually listening to both of us speak right now is going to sit there and they're listening. You go, she's making a lot of sense.
Mm-hmm.
We haven't even gotten into some of the policy stuff yet to sort of feel through that. But just broadly speaking,
how do you break through?
You're not a scary person. You're not out here. You're
I'm
not,
really not.
To be, with all due respect, you're not a whack job like Kennedy out here saying all anti-vax bullshit and crazy. You're not sitting here with the right wing radicals in their white nationalism on the Republican side. So there's a cogency here that arguably should break through, right? And it's not just the infrastructure saying we don't want Marianne anywhere near the stage.
Oh yeah, it kind what of else, is so much.
Well, what else is there though? I mean, there.
You know, I wrote you told me that you read my article about Israel and Palestine.
Yep, and we're
and I and I'd like to also point out about that. I'm the only Jew running. Do you know the Boston Globe turned me down for that op-ed? Even the Christian Science Monitor turned me out on that op-ed. I'm a declared presidential candidate, the only Jew writing a very serious article about Israel and Palestine.
So why did they tell you why?
No, it's almost like this panic. Don't let her in. It's kind of, it's absurd actually. But however, when you ask how do you break through, if anybody thinks that she should, go to Marianne2024.com and send what you can. Because you also know this, Michael, it costs money to have the digital ads. It costs money to have the TV ads. I need to have with people who are not Gen Z, the same thing I have with Gen Z, which is access to them, to talk to them. Yeah. And that goes back to TikTok and what TikTok affords me.
you did, and before we go to break, I want to get your thoughts on this. You did a very interesting interview with The Griot, which is a very well-regarded African-American publication. I've written for them in the past, in which you talked about your candidacy, and you talked about anti-Black hate and connected in a way, in a very real way, I think at a level that probably resonated with a lot of Black voters. What are you finding with the various constituencies, both inside and outside of the Democratic Party? And I do note your point about wanting to get access to them, however you can. This platform at The Griot, for example, is one that will afford you that. What was the response to that conversation? And what has been this response to your candidacy, particularly given that more and more people now talking about this sort of disengagement of Black voters inside the Democratic Party? Do you see that? Are you benefiting from that in some way?
Well, do I see that and am I benefiting? That's a kind of horse race conversation I stay away from. I have been writing, however, in my work as an author about race relations in the United States for over 20 years. And so many people do know that. They know I have been talking about reparations. I've been talking about how a nation can't go forward until it cleans up its past any more than an individual can. I've been talking about what happened, for instance, Germany paying reparations and to Jewish organizations and what that did to form psychological and emotional reconciliation, as well as financial remuneration after World War II and so forth. So people who know my work already know that I have, I've already taken a deep dive, as it were, as much as a white person can, in terms of an understanding of the underlying dynamics. However, I don't change my message depending on who I'm talking to. I could be talking about to a bunch of white billionaires, and I'm going to talk about Black children who are hungry.
Right.
But
the question message. But the question is that message resonating with the Black audiences that are out there?
Well, this is how I see it. A political campaign, particularly a presidential campaign, but any political campaign, is a long job interview. And you're a candidate for the job. And so I'm saying, this is what I would do. If you gave me the honor of placing those levers of power in my hands, this is what I would do with them. And I think that people, particularly in those primary states, they're listening and they're thinking. And I see the same looks on their faces that anybody sees on somebody interviewing for them for a job. They're listening and they'll think about it. They're not going to start voting until late January. And you know, you and I are political junkies, so we're thinking about this stuff all the time. A lot of people are just starting to take in. But I think a lot of the narrative about me and the stuff, I think a lot of people are realizing, you know what, we've got to think about what's really going on in this country, and that takes precedence over that silliness. So I get that people are thinking. And I get the Democratic voters are thinking too. People ask me all the time, for instance, in interviews, do you think the president's too old? I'm not going to weigh in on that because it feels personal. And I think people can see things for themselves. But I will tell you this, Democrats are in denial if they don't face the fact that this will be an issue for the American voter. And we should be able to have a greater discussion about who should be the candidate. Who should be the candidate?
Yeah, but objectively,
so I don't really,
but objectively, the American people have already made that decision.
They
voted for you know, Joe Biden in 20.
That's right.
But my point is, he was just 4 years younger than he is now. So there was no movement in the ensuing years. By the party or the people, for that matter, to say they want something different. Republicans similarly situated. Donald Trump is 4 years younger than Joe Biden, yet and still they've got a 40-something-year-old former governor of South Carolina, Nikki Haley, and they're like, no, thank you. So they're, you know, all of this, you know, craving noise about the age of the president. In one sense, it's just bull. Because when given the option to choose otherwise, they haven't. They didn't in 16. They didn't in 20. They didn't so far. They're not in 24, as far as I can see.
Well, first of all, I did not bring this up to say that I think it's an issue or should
be. Oh, I know
an
you
issue,
didn't. No, but I'm addressing
but
your
what
point
I do
about
think
the American,
is an issue.
I'm addressing your point that the American people think it's an issue. And what I'm saying to you is that's a ruse. At the end of the day, they don't, because they're going to choose between two octogenarians for the presidency. And they have a
Maybe.
Chance not to, and they won't take it. So all of the noise that they're making, all of the polling that they're giving pollsters saying, oh my God, Joe Biden's old and Donald Trump is it. It doesn't matter because they're not changing their behavior when it comes to that issue.
Well, you're talking about all this like all of it's a fait accompli. You're talking about it almost like it's wrapped up. And that's where you and I see things kind of differently.
Okay.
I understand that the times are getting late, but it's not wrapped up. And my point about that was not about the president's age. My point about that was meant to be that we need to be having a sophisticated conversation. The American people deserve, and in a democracy, it is required that in a thriving, functioning democracy, and not a democracy
and we're
in name only.
Not.
It is. Let me finish my sentence. Hold on a moment, please. The American people, particularly in this case, the Democratic voters or Democratic-leaning voters and independent voters, should have placed in front of them what their options are.
Mm-hmm.
The DNC should not be suppressing that. The DNC is trying to hold the lid on something, including anyone with a progressive perspective, even our own young. And that's all. I think the American people should be Bobby's not a Democrat anymore, but people should hear what the president says. People should hear what I say. People should hear what Jenks says, or people hear what Dean Phillips, if he gets in, or Gavin, whoever. But we should be having a vibrant conversation, not just, no, it will be Biden. And when my friends tell me we have to have Biden because we have to beat Trump, you know, people will say to me, Marianne, why are you doing this? Don't you realize the fascists are at the door? Michael, I'm doing this because the fascists are at the door. FDR said we would not have to worry about a fascist takeover in this country as long as democracy delivered on its promises. In the absence of universal health care, in the absence of tuition-free college, in the presence of these college loan debts, in the absence of a living wage, in the absence of affordable housing, democracy is not delivering on its promises. Unless the Democratic Party offers the American people something fundamentally better, we will lose in 2024. Telling people who can hardly make ends meet that they should be excited about the CHIPS Act. Are you kidding me?
Yeah, but Marianne, so let's do this. Let's take a quick break, and I'm going to come back and get into some of the policy, and because I think this is a good segue into some of what you're raising right now. We're going to take a little moment, and we're going to come back with presidential candidate Marianne Williams, and we're going to talk about a number of things that she has outlined as part of her economic bill of rights. And I absolutely want to get into what I thought was a very impressive and important statement that you made about Israel and Palestine. So we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, more with presidential candidate Marianne Williamson right after this.
Is it just me, or have we all lost our minds? It's a question more and more people are asking themselves, afraid to admit they already know the answer. It's also a podcast, one about people coming together in a time of division and uncertainty to talk about culture and politics, compromise and connections. It's about challenging the norms we've come to accept as a society and working together to find common ground. Fierce and Unfiltered, host Jennifer Horn is a former Republican strategist and party leader turned independent sanity activist. One way or another, we've all lost our minds. Join Jennifer Horn in the search to find them again.
Welcome back, everybody, to the Michael Steele podcast. I am honored to have presidential candidate Marianne Williamson here with us in the house, as we like to say, having a conversation. And we were, before we went to break, we were talking about the infrastructure and sort of the politics. Now I want to move us a little bit into the policy side of the equation, because we don't, as a country, have those conversations anymore. And I think you were making a very important point before we went to break about why that's important inside of a primary process among competing interests and competing candidates for the nomination, which the structures don't necessarily want to have happen. You've laid out in your campaign the what you call an economic bill of rights. And I'm going to tick off a couple so folks get a sense of where you are focusing. You talk about the right to a job that pays a living wage, the right to a voice in the workplace through a union and collective bargaining, the right to universal quality health care, the right to a cost-free higher education, the right to good, affordable housing, the right to a clean environment and healthy planet, the right to a meaningful endowment of resources at birth, the right to sound banking and financial services, the right to an equitable and fair justice system, the right to cultural and civic involvement in democratic life. All of that, broadly speaking, is sound, solid. I think every American would go, yeah, that makes sense. Of course, you and I know the devil is always in the details. How do we do that? How do we reconcile the idea of creating a right that pays a living wage when you have this sort of capitalist mindset versus all the other pieces that go into making that system work the way it does, where you have those who control the capital versus those who want access to it. Talk to us about how you see doing this as president with a Republican House that stands largely in opposition to everything I just mentioned. This iteration, well, because my kind of Republicanism, we can find work together space here, a number of these things, right? I'm not an anti-union Republican, for example, so I get it. I am, certainly I did my battle in universal health care, for example, and lost that battle. So the question now is, how do we make it work for everybody? So let's talk about that. So how, given the Republican opposition that you would have as president of the United States come January of 25,
well, first of all, we don't
have to build that bipartisan ladder.
First of all, you don't know that if I'm a president inaugurated in 2025, for all you know, it's going to be a Democratic House and a Democratic.
I'm glad
Senate,
you so said that. Okay, let's put a pin there, because I would submit to you, Madam President, You would have problems inside your own caucus with some of this.
Yeah, that's actually true.
Okay.
Actually, I would agree with that. No, I'm not naive about that. But hold on a second. Listen, we don't want the president to have a magic wand. I wouldn't have one, and no American president should have a magic wand. We have three co-equal branches of government. But the president still has the power that the president has. The president has the power of the appointments over these agencies, many of which have been captured by corporate forces. The president has the power, when necessary and if need be and if appropriate, of the executive orders. And also the president has the bully pulpit. And I think that that would be one of the greatest benefits of my presidency. I would lay it down as honestly with people as president as I lay it down honestly as a candidate. So that's number one. The president said, you know, Franklin Roosevelt said the primary responsibility importance of the Democrat of the presidency is not administrative, but moral leadership. We need a vision for this country, which interestingly enough to me is a return to the Declaration of Independence. You know, Abraham Lincoln said the Declaration of Independence is an eternal rebuke to forces of tyranny and oppression. It's like America's mission statement. John Adams said he hoped we would revisit it every July 4th. We need to revisit what our North Star is. And I would be very vocal about that. And I think that would be a large part. I would be laying down and reclaiming the American vision. Would I win every single battle? No. But I would be leaning against the wall. And I think I would be helping to create the space, whether I as president was able to effectuate those changes or not, of making them foundational in the consciousness of enough Americans that it would be inevitable that those things would occur.
So let's take the Marianne Williamson Bill of Rights, number 4, the right to a cost-free higher education. Is that the proper place for government to act? Since our educational system is both private and public, we have public schools, we have private schools. The idea that the government somehow now is going to force these institutions to do what? Because the problem is, I mean, in other words, I've sat on university boards. And I can tell you those decisions are made absent any government involvement. And so the idea of raising the cost of tuition seems to be something that we either incentivize or disincentivize these institutions to do. Parents still write the check. It does marginalize those students who otherwise would go but now can't. Where does the government play a role in that part of getting education into the hands of kids, particularly now that you're seeing it in judicial matters? The courts are like, oh, sorry, Biden administration, you that's a bridge too far.
Well, isn't it interesting? Nobody asked that question if you're talking about an eighth grader or a ninth grader. If they're an eighth or ninth grader, it's understood that in order to have an educated citizenry, as Thomas Jefferson said, people must be educated. He said the only safe repository for power is in the hands of the people. And the reason he stood for public education was so that the people had educated critical thought processes, because we must, if we are to oversee the governance of a great nation. And right now we're farming out our critical thought. Now, before the 1970s, Michael, we had it. We had it at University of Florida. We had it at University of Texas. We had it at University of California. We had it. This was not a question of the proper role of government. This is a question of the tentacles extended not by capitalism. I'm not an anti-capitalist. This is a malevolent form. Remember, Adam Smith himself, the primary architect of free market capitalism, said it cannot exist outside an ethical context. This is a malevolent form of vulture capitalism, crony capitalism. This is why you have 1.3 million people rationing their insulin in this country. You don't have that in any other advanced democracy. It's only because of the greed of the pharmaceuticals. People with a 1 in 4 medical debt, only because of the greed of the insurance company. So the way this malevolent form, and I know this might sound extreme, but I want you to really take in what I'm saying. This malevolent strain of capitalism, I do not believe it is inherent in capitalism. And I say that because some people actually do. I don't. Mm-hmm. I think there is righteous profit and so forth. I understand the high side of the free market, as I know you do. Mm-hmm. Okay. As we talked about before, my problem is not enough people can get into that. We're talking about a strain which is soulless, a strain which puts short-term profit for its own stockholders before any other stakeholders. And what do they prey on first? Human desperation. Because if human beings are desperate for something, look what they'll do. So to prey on the desperation of our young people who only want to self-actualize, who want to get in the game, who want to be young capitalists, who want to be young entrepreneurs, and you're sitting on top of them because of banks and financial institutions and educational institutions went, ooh, there's a buck to be had there. It is immoral. And absolutely, if the government, if as the Declaration of Independence said, the governments are instituted to secure the inalienable right of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. To me, a higher education is simply a part of, by which people pursue happiness. And these young people who, and they're so depressed, Michael, there are so many people, they come out of school, they took out these huge loans, and I have to tell you, debt is crippling. But I can't even imagine what it would be like to be in my 20s and carry tens of thousands of dollars of debt. So they come out of school, they got the degree in the field they want to be in, and they look at the sheet, and they look at what they owe, and they can't imagine going in, starting at the bottom, in the field that they just
got the degree in. Yeah, because the market's not paying that, right.
So they end up working at jobs they hate and wondering why they even went to college. And then you have the consequence of that is how many people are saying, now why even go to college? Like, we need more dumbing down.
Well, how do you break that cycle? I mean, what, again,
you
the
go
question
back to what
is,
we had. We had it at University of Florida. We had it at University of Texas.
So, but what does the government do to get Harvard University to cut its tuition?
Not Harvard. We're not talking about private universities. You know that. We're not talking about Harvard. We're not talking about Harvard right now, for sure. We're talking about public colleges and universities. We're not talking about Harvard. We're not talking about Dartmouth. We're not talking about Stanford.
But that's as much of, I mean, yeah, you have the choice to go to a private school versus a public school. And you're right. Public education at the university level is just as high in some cases. You know, certainly $45,000, $50,000 a year to go to a public university. But what is the underlying reason for that? Are you saying that insidious sort of greed has infected the governmental institutions of higher education, public education?
I'm saying it's infected every corner of our society, including the U.S. government. That it has become
But the U.S. government doesn't run Maryland University. The state of Maryland runs Maryland University. So what is it at the state level that is not taking into account what you just described, such that students who want to get quality education at a state-run university can do so, and they're not having to decide between, private university X and state university Y. I mean, it's obvious. I'm going to go to the state university because the quality of education is just as good as Harvard, but at half the cost. That's not the reality.
When Ronald Reagan was governor in California, he was the one who dismantled the system by which, you know, the crown jewel of California at that time was, you know, University of California, Berkeley, University of California, Santa Cruz, that was eminently affordable. So that was a state issue. It wasn't a federal issue.
Right. So, but you're talking about the right to cost-free higher education. Who's paying for that? The federal government's going to pay for that, or the state's going to pay for that, since the states are the ones that own and run the schools.
When people are more educated, when people have a college education, they have on average, I don't know what the specific average, but they make more money. And as we make more money, you have a higher tax basis. Let's talk about what they do in Australia.
Yeah, but I got to get to the school.
No, hold on. I want to answer your question. Please let me answer the question.
Let's take the high school student.
How are we going to pay for it? I'm trying to, hold on. Let me say something. When it comes to both health and education, there are many systems throughout Europe, throughout Australia, New Zealand, et cetera. We take the best. Let's talk about what they do in Australia. In Australia, for instance, someone can go as high as their achievement level will take them. Okay, you get your BA, you get the equivalent of your MA, you could even get your PhD, you go as high as your achievement level will take you. The government then registers, and we know from people's taxes how much money you're making. When you get to the point, this is what they do in Australia, and I think that's what we should do here. When you get to the point that you're beginning to pay back those loans would not in any way diminish your ability to live a minimum standard of a dignified life, the government starts paying itself back. That's what they do in Australia, and that's what we should do here.
Marianne, I
shouldn't put you on that particular committee, huh, Michael?
No, I
shouldn't put you in charge of that particular
committee.
Why do you have a problem? Why do you have a problem with what that?
I don't have a problem. I'm just trying to navigate through the reality here, and that is, our system, our educational system, is not set up the same way as Australia. The incentives are different, number one. There is much more of a federal interest in education than there is here, all right?
There should be. Look what it has done to this country.
Let me finish the point. You have people in this country, and it's not just Republicans who want to dismantle the Department of Education. So the incentives are different, number one. Number two, every state, the 50 states and the territories run their educational system, not the federal government. The state of Maryland, the state of California, the state of Florida run their systems. They have state schools. They have community colleges. They run their system. So I hear what you're saying about people getting to the point where they're going to pay back the loans. My point is, why is the number so high to begin with? And what does your right to a cost-free higher education? You say a cost-free higher education. That means the states will then take on that burden. So that means the $48,000 that it costs to go to University of Maryland or the $50,000 it costs to go to the University of Florida, the state's going to absorb that and students are going to go cost free. How do taxpayers carry that, number one?
Okay.
And number two, what are the other incentives besides basically shifting the burden?
What do you mean the other incentives besides shifting the burden? I'm not sure.
Okay. Taxpayers right now already pay for that public education.
We're already paying for it. All right. Let me tell you what else we're paying for. We're paying for the dumbing down of Americans. We're paying for the fact that only 11 states require American history, American civics, and American government. Hold on a moment. We are paying a terrible cost for the dumbing down of Americans, but I want to go back to FDR and the GI Bill. Everybody understands that the GI Bill, allowing the veterans who came back from World War II to get an education, that built America's middle class. Now, what Franklin Roosevelt wanted was tuition-free college for every American. The Southern racist senators didn't want that because they didn't want to educate Black people. But given what the GI Bill did to build the American middle class, can you imagine what it would do for our economy if everyone had been afforded that right? We should be thinking more than just immediate. We should be thinking about investing in our future. America needs a more educated population. Right now, you have to be among the privileged to have access to healthcare, to have easy access to education.
But you've got Obamacare. You don't need to be privileged to have Obamacare.
You guys won that fight. Hold on a second. 85 million of the neoliberal, the corporatist Democrats won. Hold on a moment. 85 million Americans are underinsured or uninsured.
But what was the point of Obamacare?
But that's the whole point. You still have one in four Americans living with medical debt. That's why we need Medicare for all. That's why we need universal health care. You have 18 million Americans who cannot afford to pay for the prescriptions their doctors give them. What happens, and I've had doctor after doctor tell me this. I've had doctors say, I don't even know why I'm practicing anymore. Because the insurance will cover for you to go to the doctor, but the insurance won't cover the tests that the doctor prescribes. It won't cover the medicine. It won't cover the operation.
Yeah,
it won't. So, so our, no, no what Obamacare was, problem. What Obamacare was the insurance company saying to Obama, this is as far as we'll let you go.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. I know.
That's what the corporatist Democrats represent, as far as the insurance companies will let you go. As far as big oil will let you go. As far as by laying it down and saying it, by laying it so that the American people hear me.
But the American people know that. They know it. And this is just
listen, the American people will be gaslighted.
It goes back to my point about AIDS. The American people know everything you're describing. They bitch, they moan about the cost of this, that, and everything, and they continue.
But they don't hear. They don't
vote
hear
the same people who give them the same bucket of gruel.
No. Hold on, Michael. Bernie, the polls show Bernie would have won in 2016.
Bernie wouldn't have won, Jack.
Okay, hold on. Jack. What we do know, well, you and I are going to disagree on that. No one will ever know, but the poll said it. The point is the American people
Donald Trump wasn't going to win. Hillary Clinton was going to win.
We can't go. Hold on. The American people were not given in 2016, in the final analysis, they were not given the possibility of voting for a presidential candidate who said we're going to have Medicare for all, universal health care. So Trump didn't say it. In fact, and Biden didn't say it. They weren't given the opportunity. Don't put it on the American people.
Marianne,
and I know from my own experience how hard the system does to suppress anyone who suggests it.
You start stepping on my toes.
What? Am I stepping on your toes?
No. Yes, I was going to say, I can dance with you until you start.
Stepping on your toes?
Yeah, because the American people are not absent in this political process. They are not
more
zombies.
Absent than they should be.
They're not zombies. I get to a point where people just like, you know, the American people, we need to educate, we need to inform. Well, damn it.
No, we need to give them the chance. You're talking to someone who is suggesting Medicare for all, which the majority of Republicans as well as Democrats want. And this candidacy is being suppressed for that reason.
I hear what you're saying.
And I know you know that that's true.
I know, but I'm
there's
just saying.
There's a suppression
saying,
of the candidacies.
Michael,
so the American
back.
People are not being given the opportunity to vote for that candidate, although that might change in the next 4 months.
That may change, but I don't see a groundswell of Americans saying put Marianne on in play. I don't see
because
that
they don't see Marianne. You hear it among Gen Z.
I think people know you're there. You're there. You've already said they know you're there on TikTok. I don't see.
Yeah, and they are I don't want to personalize it that much. Maybe they irrelevant. It's the issue. That's relevant.
Right. I'm not trying to personalize it that much. Because look, I wouldn't have you on the podcast if I didn't ever want to have the conversation, because I love talking.
Yeah,
with you.
I know. Because me too.
You really have some really interesting things to say about a lot of important stuff. But I'm just saying the other side of the coin for a candidate like you. And I know this from all the work that I've done with candidates over the years. Is the frustration that in one sense, yes, you can rail at the system and the system does block and tackle you out of position, given. I totally agree with that. And I've tried to change that in my limited way inside the party over the years. But the other side of the equation is how much the American people allow that to happen. And how much they have already bought into this idea that what the parties put up is all I have a choice.
That's very true. People have been trained to expect too little. People have been trained to limit their political imaginations. I do think that's going to change with this younger generation, because the younger generation, they look at the people their same age in every other advanced democracy. They have health care. Why don't I?
Right.
They have tuition-free college and tech school. Why don't I? I think that this younger generation, you're right, everybody else has just been trained to just accept what they're given. There's not enough rambunctiousness. And unfortunately, it breaks my heart, and I'm sure you agree with me, some of this good old rambunctiousness, hell no, I won't take it, is being displaced and being expressed by some of the most extreme alt-right elements in our society, we should see more of that rambunctiousness in a healthy way among the average American.
I want to, before I let you go, and I've kept you longer than I promised I would, but like I said, I love engaging with you, and I could have gone through more of the policy, and we'd be throwing down for an hour or more. But I do want to turn everyone's attention to an important piece that you wrote entitled Israel and Hamas, An Eye for an Eye Leaves Everyone Dead. And it was your statement about the events unfolding in Israel. I love the way you kind of set it up and started the conversation that you were about to engage in. You said, quote, black and white thinking will help no one and has no place in any serious analysis of the current situation. You go on. No one expected the United States to not go after Al-Qaeda after 9/11, and no one should expect Israel not to go after Hamas. Of course, we did, and of course, they will. Then you go on, while I have cried for days about an event that exterminated 10 times more Jews than died on the night of Kristallnacht, now I'm crying the same infuriated and helpless tears for over 2 million people who live in Gaza, over half of whom are children. Hamas is not the Palestinian people. Broker peace between Israel and the Palestinians. That's what you like to see happen. If you said if you're president, you would not have moved the U.S. embassy back to Tel Aviv. You would move the U.S. embassy back to Tel Aviv, and you would not have allowed the Abraham Accords to minimize the cause of justice for Palestinians. Talk to me about the piece, and I tried to pull a few highlights there. That I think it's important for people to hear from you, not just from the standpoint of being an American Jew, to being a politician, a presidential candidate, but giving us a sense of what we still get wrong about what's happening between Palestine and the Jews.
You know, it's interesting because having been to Israel several times, the conversation in Israel is far more nuanced than here. Here, on the issue of Israel and Palestine, as in so many issues, we keep the conversation so simplistic. There are people who glorify the needs of Israel, the security of Israel, at the expense of the legitimate rights of the Palestinians. And there are people who stand for the legitimate issues of the Palestinians, but sometimes with some real historical inaccuracy, and fail to acknowledge the legitimacy of human rights and security rights of the Israelis, and even the existence of Israel. We will not go forward from either one of those extremes. Neither one tell the whole truth. The truth is not an either or here. The truth is a both and. And I think that that's true of many things in American politics today. We need to mature to the place where we can hold the juxtaposition of what might seem to be oppositional truths, but really aren't. We have to find the truth in between. First of all, the barbaric acts of last Saturday, pure evil. Mm-hmm. And we need to name that. And we need to acknowledge it. Completely, there is no excuse. I'm sorry. There is no justification. And as you read, Israel has, no one should blame them for going after Hamas. The big question, which is a very serious question, is whether or not invading Gaza is the correct action. I don't believe it's the morally correct action because of what you read there in terms of the Gazans who have nothing to do with Hamas. Mm-hmm. There's no evidence that the majority support Hamas. Some would argue with that, but there's no evidence for that. And even if they do support, if you're going to say that, this idea of collective guilt, those kids at that music festival who were slaughtered on Saturday were probably not Netanyahu voters, to be honest. A lot of lefty peaceniks were living there near mm-hmm. Gaza. So to blame one group of people for what their government does, that has to stop. Many of us did not agree with the Iraq war. We weren't George Bush or Trump. So that's true of both the Israelis and the people of Gaza. So there is no justification for what Hamas did, and Hamas needs to be squashed. I totally support that. And this did not come out of nowhere. And there have been years in which the legitimate rights of the Palestinians have been minimized. Israel is not genocidal, but it has been unjust and repressive with many of its policies towards the Palestinians, and that is simply fact. And the United States too often has been willing, if not to look away, to simply, well, to go, okay, you shouldn't, but as president, I would have taken a much stronger stand about the illegality of the settlements, about the illegality of the occupation continuing for this long, about the immorality of the blockade, and so forth. When you have large groups of desperate people, large groups of desperate people become a petri dish out of which yes. all manner of societal dysfunction is almost inevitable, including ideological capture by genuinely psychotic forces.
That's so you put your finger on a very interesting and I think underappreciated point. And I've heard it in the last week since this horrific attack from a number of, traditional conservative Jews, that at the end of the day, Israel's policy towards the Palestinian people fomented this kind of ugliness that Hamas took advantage has taken advantage of, and so the even among Jews, both there in Israel and here at home, there is this sense of we've got to rethink this, which is why I think your framing of not, you know, this was horrific, but rather this was horrific and is going to be a very interesting new point of the spear, if you will, an interesting way forward. Do you see that gathering, that idea that you've posited, gathering a little bit more emphasis, that on the heels of this, we now have to all step back and recognize how policies may have contributed to the underlying rot that Hamas is exploiting and taking advantage of, particularly given the very youthful population there, you know, ginning up these young, Palestinian men to act out as they look around and see nothing but poverty and no future and repression. How real is that opportunity to change the dynamic of this conversation on the heels of what's happened?
You need a president who is willing to recognize it. I think it would be good to have a Jew in that position. And I, as a Jewish woman who loves Israel and who have been horrified actually by some of the reaction to this event, some people wouldn't even give us a day to just honor our dead.
Right.
I've been horrified by that. And I'm horrified by any compromise with the idea that those acts were in any way, that they were completely, they were evil, they were unacceptable. And we've got too much excusing people's bad behavior going on today, whether it has to do with Vladimir Putin or Hamas or anyone else. We're really reaping the result of a society that's become too morally relative in terms of that. But I believe that all of us are mature enough to recognize now that at the end of all this, and I think the United States should take an active role in this, we're going to have to create a phoenix of peace that arises out of all this. One way or the other, and I pray it's not through this invasion. I think the United States supporting this invasion is a really bad idea. After 9/11, there was a lot of conversation about treating this as an international incident. And I believe that invading, if you just invade Hamas and thousands and thousands of Gazans die and thousands of Israelis die in a horrible war, and particularly if, God forbid, Hezbollah gets involved, Iran gets involved, we really need to understand, you know, when it comes to the Ukrainian war, some people would say to me, you know, Marianne, this could lead to World War III. And I'm like, I don't see that. This one, this could spin out of control in ways that I think it's very irresponsible for any of us not to recognize. One way or the other, however, we will be on the other side of this. And the United States should take a very active role in helping to redesign what is going to have to be Israel and Palestine based on greater justice. The problem is what Hamas did put the cause of justice for the Palestinians back by decades, if not longer.
Mm-hmm.
We don't know what's going to happen here, but I know that if I'm president, I will be actively participatory in creating a path forward that will not come from a consciousness of brute force. It will come from a consciousness of reconciliation and a much more evolved understanding that we must be committed to the fact that all men are created equal. You know, our highest alliance must be with humanity itself. And I think that is the only way forward. And I think everybody can see right now, this is simply too hot a spot on the planet. We let it fester. We should not have let it fester. That in no way excuses the activity of Hamas, but we must think anew. As Lincoln said, as our circumstances are new, as our situation is new, whatever that line was, we must think anew and act anew. And I think that's what I represent as a candidate, a 21st century thinking. We keep applying 20th century thinking to 21st century problems, black and white, brute force. It's not going to work. And that's why I feel that I bring something to the table that would be something genuinely new and reparative for this country.
2024 Democratic candidate for President of the United States, Marianne Williamson. I really enjoyed the conversation. I hope those of you listening did as well. Thank you so much, Marianne, for coming.
Thank you.
Coming back into the room and having another round with me across important topics. Thank you.
I always enjoy talking to you, and thank you so much for having me.
Absolutely. That does it for this time together, folks. Please, if you have a chance, check out Marianne on Twitter at Marianne Williamson. The website, Marianne, where people can go and learn more about your campaign.
Thank you. Marianne, Marianne, 2024.com.
There you go. So go check it out yourself, folks. Be informed, intelligent voter. You've got choices, you've got options. And that's something I've always advocated for as a county chairman, state chairman, national chairman, to create those options for voters. I hope we've given you something to think about today with Marianne coming on and being a part of the conversation. Until next time, folks, take care of yourselves. Be safe out there. My prayers are with the people of Israel and with the good people of Palestine, who are now caught in a very dangerous space. And hopefully our leaders, right, they're supposed to be leaders, actually see a pathway forward where we can survive this together. So let's keep that in front of mind as we get ready for what comes next. Until next time, take care.
Facepalm America is a show for progressives and others on the left who want to keep up with the ridiculousness that this country dishes out, find out what cable news misses when they're waiting for Trump to appear at a podium, and also, every once in a while, get a laugh at how silly this hot mess of a nation of ours really is. If that's you, listen to Facepalm America. You can go to facepalmamerica.com or find us on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.